Join us now for the award-winning Henry Wolf Show with your host, Henry Wolf, and his guest, the former Vice President of the United States and now United States Senator from Minnesota, the Honorable Hubert H. Humphrey.
I'm Ron Majors.
Sure.
Thank you.
Senator Humphrey, once more. Senator Humphrey, you left on August 31st, 1974, with two other senators and four members of the United States House for China, the People's Republic.
Yes.
Of China. Before you went, one of your colleagues in the United States Senate, a Democrat from Washington, Henry Scoop Jackson,
yes,
who is traveling a great deal and running very hard, went also to China. And when he returned, he had a news conference in which he said, I am calling for full diplomatic recognition of the People's Republic of China and withdrawal of the United States Embassy in Taiwan. I believe that the United States-China relationship must be strengthened by moving beyond contacts between a limited number of personalities to a more institutionalized process and a far wider range of exchanges and relationships. And he urged new departures in Sino-American relations, including the establishment of resident correspondents in each country, more substantial programs of cultural and educational exchanges, and the settlement of this assets issue. There are $197 million, I think it is,
yes,
being claimed by United States citizens who say they have sustained losses in this amount after the Chinese communists came to power in 1949. But that's an issue apart. What comment do you have on some of the things he says? Full diplomatic recognition, withdrawal of our United States Embassy in Taiwan.
Well, I don't find myself in much disagreement with that, if any, Henry. It seems to me that that it is in our national interest now to further our relationships with the People's Republic of China. I would have to say, however, that Senator Jackson may feel that this is the way we ought to proceed, and I may feel that's the way, but the Chinese also have something to say about that. They want to have the whole issue of Taiwan settled before there is full diplomatic relations. In other words, the feeling in the Chinese government, as we visited with the Chinese officials, was that the Taiwan issue had to be settled. That is, Taiwan had to become a part of the mainland of China. And I think that that's a question that they will have to resolve, as well as we ourselves, in terms of our diplomatic recognition. But I personally feel that the time has come for us to do everything within our power to normalize the relationships with the People's Republic of China, to encourage the Chinese to do this, for us to you can't have ambassadors both in Taiwan and in China and have normal diplomatic relations. That's a fact. The Chinese will not go for that, and so that it seems to me that in a short period of time we ought to make those adjustments.
Senator, this is a very hypothetical question, but if you assume for a minute that you would have been elected president in 1968 and that you would have laid the groundwork, as Dr. Kissinger did for former President Nixon, and you are Nolan Swarland's qualified as a liberal Democrat. The liberal should be maybe in quotations, but that's what many people think.
Yes,
you are.
Yes. I think I am too. Yes, sir.
If you would have done what former President Nixon did, what do you think would have been the reaction of the majority of the people in the United States been?
Well, I would have done what President Nixon did do, that is the opening to China. I said that in 1968 when I ran for the presidency. Of course, you recall that Mr. Nixon spent his whole political career prior to the time he became president assailing people for being friendly to the People's Republic of China. In other words, he was a China firster, as they call it, and he was bitterly opposed to the PRC, the People's Republic regime, and the Chinese Communist government. When he became president, he changed. And of course, he looked at the realities. Some of us had already made that change before he became president, and I was one of them. I'm sure that had I made the visit to China, using your hypothetical now for a moment, that I would have been severely condemned and criticized by a number of people, the more conservative wing of the Republican Party, the Ronald Reagan wing, for example, of the Republican Party. I believe I would have been condemned by Mr. Nixon himself, because out of office he was one thing, and in office he was another. Somebody once said, where you stand often depends on where you sit. And when he was sitting in the presidency, he was standing a little bit differently on issues than he was when he was a candidate or when he was a congressman or a senator. But nevertheless, this decision had to be made, and I applauded the former president's decision. As you know, I supported him very vigorously in this opening to China. I think it was necessary. That does not mean that we approve of their political system. It does not mean that we seek to emulate it. It just simply means that there are 800 million people in that part of the world, and you can't pretend they're not there. And it is a political madness to continue that kind of a relationship. And obviously, we had to change, and we did.
Senator, you are very much concerned with our agricultural problems, and there are many. It was announced that in 1973, China bought some 750,000 bales of United States cotton.
Yes.
Now, the Kansas City Times of August 21, 1973 said that this was the equivalent to the amount of cotton exported to all countries during the previous year, at a time when we don't have enough food for our own people, where our farmers are in very bad situations. Our cotton farmers, our wheat farmers. Do you think it is right and wise to go out and sell or maybe loan 750,000 bales of United States cotton to the People's Republic of China?
I surely do, because we had many more bales of cotton than that. 750,000 bales of cotton was a surplus that was hanging over the market, the cotton market, destroying for all practical purposes the cotton economy, and it was important that we sell it. Now, I think you have to have reserves. You know my feeling about having both food and fiber reserves. But the sale to China was at a good price, and it did not injure the farmer. Or to the contrary, it helped the farmer. And we are not short of textiles in the United States, and we haven't been short of textiles. As a matter of fact, the synthetic textile industry was making severe inroads in on the cotton textiles. And therefore, to be able to export our cotton was a very important thing for us to do. Now, I think you have to be just careful about how much you export, whether or not you move so far and so fast that you jeopardize your own domestic supply. In the instance of cotton, I don't think we jeopardized our domestic supply. The Russian wheat deal, I think, did severely drain down our feed grain reserves and our wheat reserves. And that, I think, we ought to be, something like that, we ought to be exceedingly careful.
There's another thing we have been selling and offering to the People's Republic, and that is mining machinery.
Yes.
And what's more important, giant fertilizer plants. And the initial delivery of the 8 chemical fertilizer plants, which is stretched out over 3 years, began last month.
Yes, sir.
Now, fertilizer is not hanging in the air and available for everybody. What is your feeling on that?
Well, Henry, what we're doing is exporting our technology, and we're exporting some of our equipment. Obviously, we have a need of these exports. Now, if you want to build fertilizer plants, you can build them in the United States. But regrettably, some of our companies don't want to build fertilizer plants. And it's better to build the fertilizer plant in China than it is to drain off what little fertilizer we have. Well, we have quite a lot, but what fertilizer we have in the United States to ship it overseas. Quite honestly, the answer to some of the agricultural and food problems in the world is the building of fertilizer plants. Building them in India, building them in China. They're building 13 of them in China, as a matter of fact, and building them in the Middle East, because fertilizer is essential for agricultural production, particularly in the old areas of the world where the land has been eroded and where it has not been cared for too well. So I'm not opposed to this at all. Now, were we to ship from the United States the actual processed fertilizer at the expense of the American farmer and the American consumer, that is another question. I would not support that. But to have our technicians, and that's really what it boils down to, it is our technicians working with the Chinese and oftentimes using Chinese steel, using Chinese developed metals of their own to develop fertilizer plants in China, I don't think that. I think that's in our national interest. We've got to sell something because we have to buy. If we're unable to sell our high technology, and that's what a fertilizer plant is, and our airplanes, and that's another high technology item, and our food and cotton, how are we going to pay for this oil? We'll be bankrupt. I think the American people have to understand that that trade is a two-way street. We can't just buy. We can't just have things come in and not have anything go out.
You just spoke of oil. David Rockefeller has founded the National China Council for United States-China Trade. And members of this council are some very prestigious personality. I don't want to go into
yes.
all the names, but Mr. Blumenthal of Bendix and Thornton Wilson of Boeing Aircraft, Lucian Pai of MIT, etc., etc. Because there seems to be, according to some studies made, massive underseas oil reserves along the China's east and southeast coast.
Yes.
And long-term development of these resources, which are believed to exceed all the world's presently known reserves. Now, what are we going to get out, if anything, of these reserves, if that materializes?
Well, let's first of all just pin down that there are oil reserves in China. There's no doubt about that. When I visited China, I learned that a great deal of oil is presently being shipped to Japan. As a matter of fact, the Japanese are a big customer of the Chinese and have long-term contracts for oil that is being produced in the northeastern section of China in the old Manchurian area. And it is now well established that there are underwater oil resources in the territorial waters and immediately off the coastline of certain parts of China. I predict that China will have large oil reserves without any comment about the statement you read. And it will be a big oil exporter because its own industrial economy doesn't use that much oil at this particular time. And they'll sell it to whomever they can sell it to because the Chinese are anxious to do business. They have to pay for large import food items and machine tools. When they import parts for a fertilizer plant, when they import heavy machinery for a steel plant, or whatever else they import from Western Europe, the United States, and Japan, and that's where they really make their major buys, they've got to have something to export. And what they're exporting, they have coal, all kinds of coal, vast deposits of coal, and they obviously will have oil. So. I don't think we're going to get any bargain, Henry, any more than they get a bargain when they buy corn from us. They pay the market price. If they buy wheat from Canada, they pay the market price. If we have to buy oil, we'll have to pay the market price. But I think it's important to note that as these new discoveries are made, inevitably that can have and ought to have some pressure on the price, pushing it down, because there will be a greater abundance of oil. And I think we're just beginning to find some of these new resources. Look what they found off the coast of Mexico here the other day, 10 times larger than what we discovered up in Alaska. And we're beginning to find in the North Sea new deposits of oil. The Norwegians have just hit into a great new oil field. So as the demand for oil becomes even more explicit, and the Arabs have raised this oil price, development is going on. The Arabs are not going to have a hammerlock on oil very long, Henry Wolfe. They're going to find out that they may have overplayed their hand.
I have one more serious question for you, but first, we have this message.
Winter dry.
Humphrey, I'd like to get back to agriculture in a minute, but first, there's one thing which I said was a rather serious one, and that is that we know that the Chinese have been testing nuclear weapons over quite some time, especially at the Lop Nor Test Center in northwest China. The United States experts say that China has hydrogen bombs with a blast equivalent of 3 million tons of TNT and a variety of smaller tactical nuclear weapons that could be carried by missiles and aircraft.
Yes.
We got to think of that.
Absolutely. That, of course, is one of the facts of life. China had her first successful nuclear tests in the mid-60s. She's had a number of them since then, and I should tell you...
Two this year.
Yes. Most of the experts were always underestimating the Chinese. I remember full well that the Secretary of Defense, the former Secretary, Mr. McNamara, at one time indicated that the Chinese would not be able to develop a certain type of weapon until the 1970s. It actually was developed in the 1960s. We've underestimated their technological and scientific competence. They're highly trained. By the way, many of these people were trained in the United States, and they're older scientists. And the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, University of California at Berkeley, great universities. And that gives us, by the way, too, a reservoir of goodwill. These men like to see Americans. They remember their days in the United States, but it gave them this scientific preeminence. As I see it for the moment, and when I say for the moment, let's say in the decade of the 70s, there's very little danger of the Chinese having an intercontinental ballistic missile with any degree of accuracy. They may very well develop the bomb, that is, the warhead, but to send a missile 5,000 miles, and they'd have to send it even further than that if they were going to attack the United States, which I don't think they're going to do. The guidance system, they have not as yet perfected. That is the tough item. That's the most difficult thing to really develop. Also, as you know, we have now gone to a form of what we call MIRVs, the multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, so that a warhead has several bombs that can be independently targeted. But China must be included in any kind of disarmament talks. And China must be included in any kind of nuclear discussions. It's one thing for us to have a nuclear treaties with the Soviet Union, which for the moment is highly desirable if you can get a good treaty, one that's fair, one that you can supervise, one that on which you can't cheat. But in the, let's say, in the next 5 to 10 years, China must be brought into that because China is a member of the nuclear club. Right now, what the Chinese are developing those weapons for, I don't believe has anything to do with the United States. It has something to do with the Soviet Union. The Chinese look upon the Soviet Union, as of now, as a threat to them. And they know there are 1 million Russians on their border. They know that there are nuclear installations near their border. And the Chinese are very, very concerned about Russian pressure. They don't trust the Russians. They've had some experiences with them in the 1950s and the 1960s, border incidents, struggles that they've had with them, and severe military clashes that makes the Chinese very wary of the Russians. And I'm confident that one of the reasons that the Chinese have the nuclear weapon is to give some kind of protection against any possible Russian aggression.
You traveled in the People's Republic of China for 2 weeks.
Yes.
Can we trust them?
At this stage, I think so. I think you always have to be on guard with any of the great powers. China, as yet, is not what you would call a great power. It has the great potential of being a great power. China is essentially concerned about itself right now, and it has historically been, as you know, a very insular, provincial type of people. That's what the Great Wall is all about. They wanted to keep out everybody else and keep themselves in a kind of closed society. They've resisted any kind of foreign intervention of any kind. Even today, the Chinese, while they accept foreign technology, for example, and are willing to pay for it, they make it very clear to you that they want to be totally independent. Their slogans today are self-reliance, hard work, independence, study. That's what they believe in. The Chinese tell us quite candidly that they can get along with us, and I think they're making choices between ourselves and the Soviet Union. I see our future with them to be primarily in the trade field. They're going to need products, machine tools. They're going to need for the foreseeable future a considerable amount of agricultural product in order to upgrade the diet of their people, even though their agriculture has made tremendous strides since 1949. I'd say yes, that for the moment, if we are careful, and we ought to always be careful, there's no serious, there's no danger from China.
In the area of agriculture, what did you learn during your trip you didn't know before?
I learned that, interestingly enough, that the Chinese Communist Party, and that's, it runs parallel with the government, Mao and his administration, are essentially oriented towards agriculture. Mao is a country boy. He was a peasant. Two-thirds of the Politburo, the governing body of China, are peasants. And they're the people that grew up in the farms. The Chinese communists were not successful in their first revolutionary attempts in the city of Shanghai. They started their revolution and carried it on in the countryside, out of where 85% of China's population is rural. So the government today in China has put a high priority not upon building steel plants and cement plants as much as it has on making its agriculture more efficient and more productive. And they've done an amazing job of doing it. They say they have the four, they call it the four: fertilization, irrigation, mechanization, and conservation. This is what they're trying to do: conserve their land, conserve their water, mechanize, fertilize, and then of course produce. And they're doing a good job at it. I saw double cropping, in other words, two crops in one field, two crops a year, or three crops a year. It's mostly all hand labor. They've built huge irrigation works, just like the Dutch, Henry, have pushed back the sea in order to expand their agricultural base. The Chinese are pushing back the mountains, going up the side of the mountains with terracing, bringing in topsoil, which is a compost. They save all animal waste and human waste. They put four or five times a year this compost or this human-made fertilizer upon their croplands. They're doing a good job, and they built a fine rural transportation system. They've got good trains. Actually, their trains run on time, and their roadbed is smooth. I wish the American railroads would go over and take a look at how they've done that. They've built a fairly good system, a network of farm-to-market roads. They have established a whole series of agricultural experiment stations, like we run out of our own University of Minnesota here. They have the county agent system that reaches out into the peasantry. They've organized their agriculture into what we call communes. Those are huge cooperatives in which the people pool their efforts, work together, and harvest their crops together and plant together, and it has done well.
Senator, when politicians of your stature begin to travel to foreign lands, I mentioned Senator Jackson.
Yes.
To China, Senator Mondale to Russia, you and China. There are many people who say that maybe you want to take a very close look at these countries, because you might be called on in 1976 to be the nominee for the presidency of your party. Have you anything like that in mind?
Not a bit. And Henry, I have been traveling as long as I've been in public life, because I think it's important. I know that frequently you read in the press about junkets. I've never taken a junket in my life. It's hard work. It's hard work. Now, some people may take a junket. I've been to the Soviet Union 5 times. I'm going to the World Food Conference at Rome, which I helped initiate. I shall be traveling also in the Middle East. As a United States senator that has to vote on critical issues, and sometimes one vote is the difference, I believe in being informed. And I sometimes have, now that I'm a little older and not so worried about what people may think of me about some things, I deeply resent the kind of cheap journalism that attacks these trips that people take. Because these are absolute...
I didn't mean it.
Not you, Henry. I didn't mean you, bless your heart. But I've read, you've read about that. You'll say, well, he took a junket. Now, some people may do that. But I want to tell you that if you're going to know anything about China, you're not going to find it out by reading the local press as good as it is. You're going to have to go there. America is a world power with a half-world knowledge. That's what gets us into trouble. And we equate power with knowledge. I suggest that we equate knowledge with power. If you know something, then you can be a better person. And to travel like to imagine a person having been in Congress 20-some years and never having ever been to China, where is 1/4 of the world's population, never having read much about it except they were a bunch of communists. Well, there are also 800 million people.
We have 10 seconds, Senator. J. William Fulbright will not be longer the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Who is, in your opinion, going to be his successor?
John Sparkman of Alabama.
Thank you, Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, for being our guest here. We wish you well indeed.
Thank you, Henry.
Join us next Sunday for another edition of the Henry Wolf Show. Now, this is Henry Wolf bidding you all goodbye, and thank you for watching.
Join us again next week for another Henry Wolf Show with your host, Henry Wolf, and his guest, David Douglas Duncan, author...